previous month. Shapiro was unimpressed by the accounting. It was amazing the crap they would try to tell us they were doing just so that we would reimburse them. The bills would list specific actions such as 17-tow anti-tank missiles fired at enemy targets in the federally administered tribal areas, accompanied by a price tag in the tens of thousands of dollars. The Pakistanis billed out air defense expenses such as radar tracking, even though the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had no air force. Judging by their invoices, they were expending ammunition at a rate that exceeded that of American combat units in Afghanistan, even though the Pakistani military was rarely in the fight against militants during this period. Shapiro asked, "What did you fire the missiles at? What is your battle damage assessment?" Yet he never received documented answers. The Pakistan Navy would bill him on a per diem formula for sailors on duty fighting the global war on terrorism. Shapiro thought that was laughable. What were these sailors doing to thwart Al-Qaeda? Supposedly, the Pakistan Navy conducted patrols to prevent Al-Qaeda members from escaping by sea. The most egregious cases concerned supposed road construction to support Pakistani military operations, especially in the country's western tribal areas. If Shapiro had sat down and counted all the roads they claimed to have built, he thought, Pakistan's tribal areas would have been one big asphalt parking lot. Yet when Shapiro challenged the bills or demanded proof, word came down to him from superiors to just stop asking questions and sign off on this stuff. The Pentagon was content with blanket subsidies. His orders were to pass on the requests for coalition support funds, even though we knew all of this stuff was trumped up. The coalition support funds provided a kind of legal bribery to Pakistan's generals. Musharraf and his lieutenants could use the cash for legitimate military purposes, or they could spread it around as they wished. Theoretically, if the Pakistani generals came to depend on the American largesse, they might moderate their conduct to align with the Bush administration's aims in the region, so as to avoid being cut off. The money did not buy love, but it did seem to purchase a certain level of cooperation and tolerance. Musharraf delivered by arresting Al-Qaeda fugitives in Pakistan while evading accountability on Taliban or Kashmiri militants. The ISI did betray a few highly visible Taliban leaders, such as Ambassador Mullah Zaif. The Pakistanis arrested him and turned him over to the Americans, who shipped him to Guantanamo. Yet, as many other high-ranking Taliban officeholders melted into Quetta, the ISI ignored them or claimed they could not be located. According to Hank Crumpton of the Counterterrorist Center, the CIA suffered from a lack of intelligence, lack of access and collection in Quetta, now the Taliban's principal sanctuary. The agency accepted dependence to some degree on the Pakistanis to identify high-value Taliban suspects hiding there. In any event, after 2001, Mullah Omar was a secondary target for the CIA. Cooperating ISI officers were chasing down key Al-Qaeda targets and rendering them to us. The feeling at Langley was, why push them and why anger them by harping about the defeated Taliban? Another motivation was to keep as close to ISI as possible, so that CIA case officers in Islamabad or offshore could identify and recruit ISI officers as unilateral American sources. The CIA might not be able to recruit many important Al-Qaeda defectors. That organization has proved to be a very hard target. But surely there were ISI officers who might be willing to work with the CIA and who knew or could find out where Osama bin Laden had taken shelter. Robert Grenier and his ISI counterparts set up a joint intelligence operations cell in a walled safe house in Islamabad, from where they targeted Al-Qaeda fugitives. They pooled tips, directed surveillance, and planned raids on suspected compounds in Pakistani cities. Islamabad stations swelled with temporarily deployed CIA officers, FBI agents, eavesdroppers, and contractors. TDYers, as they were known in U.S. government jargon, referring to their short, temporary deployments. And just as the CIA had infused the Afghan National Directorate of Security with cash, The agency now poured tens of millions of dollars into ISI's counterterrorism directorate. The payments took the form of reward money for the capture of specific al-Qaeda leaders, as well as investments in new facilities, vehicles, technology, and training. It did not require deep experience in Pakistan to understand that even though ISI's counterterrorism directorate found it profitable to operate with the Americans against al-Qaeda, other ISI directorates might simultaneously monitor and support Pakistan's indigenous jihadi clients, including the Taliban. The Bush administration and the CIA accepted this arrangement as necessary, if chronically frustrating, during 2002 and 2003. As John McLaughlin, then the CIA's deputy director, put it, "We were getting traction on al-Qaeda. In a war situation, you're drawn to where you can succeed. The attraction of going after al-Qaeda was just so great." All along, it was clear what ISI wanted from the United States, besides cash and arms. Pakistan sought greater influence in Kabul to counter India's presumed influence over Hamid Karzai and the Northern Alliance. India had funded the Northern Alliance before 2001, and Karzai had attended school in the country. During this period, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Vice Admiral Thomas Wilson, visited headquarters. He met Director General Ehsan Ul Haq. The ISI chief opened the meeting with a 30-minute monologue about what a terrible ally of Pakistan the United States had proved to be over the years. The Nixon administration had stood by as India dismembered Pakistan during the 1971 war, he noted. The first Bush administration and then the Clinton administration washed their hands of Pakistan after the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, leaving Pakistan alone to bear the costs of refugees, heroin addiction, and loose guns. September 11th has provided another opportunity, the ISI chief continued. But now, once again, the United States was neglecting Pakistan's legitimate desire to influence Afghanistan. The interim government in Kabul is being led by the three musketeers of the Northern Alliance, Haq said bitterly. He meant Fahim Khan, Karzai's Minister of Defense, Yunus Kanuni, another former lieutenant of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was Minister of Interior, and Abdullah Abdullah, a third former Massoud aide, who was Minister of Foreign Affairs. The Russians and Iranians had infiltrated Afghanistan through the Northern Alliance and were in there with a vengeance, the ISI director continued. I'm speaking with my heart, but Pakistan has suffered as an ally of the United States. He summoned for Wilson two brigadiers from ISI's analysis directorate. They advanced their boss's talking points. The ethnic composition of the government in Kabul is unbalanced, one of them complained. As soon as the U.S. leaves, there will be a return to chaos. It was a forecast that could also be read as a threat. Since the 1970s, the Haqqani network had been a linchpin of ISI's covert policy. The network consisted of thousands of fighters along the Pakistan-Afghan border, relatively close to Kabul. The network drew funds and volunteers from a web of smuggling businesses, fundraising operations in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Gulf, and prestigious Islamic schools. As with so many other nodes of influence in Pakistan and Afghanistan, at the network's heart lay an extended family empowered by war and instability. The family's home village lay in the Wazi-Zadran district of Afghanistan's Paktia province, close to the porous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan's tribal agency of North Waziristan. Before the Second World War, a family patriarch, Khaja Mohammed Khan, owned land and traded on both sides of the border. His son, Jalaluddin, was born in 1939, followed by several other boys. Khan had means to enroll his boys at a conservative Deobandi madrasa in Pakistan's northwest frontier province, known as Dar-ul-Ulum Haqqaniya. The Deobandi School of Islam, born in northern India, was a rule-prescribing sect that sought a purer faith. The madrasa also had ties to an Islamist political party in Pakistan, the Jamiat Ulema-i-Islam, or JUI. Jalaluddin graduated with an advanced education in 1970 and took his school's name as his own, as did his brothers. He dabbled in electoral politics before the spread of communist ideology in Afghanistan drew him into the skirmishes of an incipient jihad against the communists and secularists as early as 1973. As Abdul Salam Rakati, a former Taliban commander who met with Jalaluddin over the years, put it, "His background was in politics. He was a politician and also a religious scholar. He had plans. He always seemed to have some secret plans that I did not know about. This was his personality." Geography, above all, determined the family's rise to wealth and power during the anti-Soviet war of the 1980s. The key to ISI's strategy in the war was to exploit the relatively short distance between its frontier in North Waziristan and the capital of Kabul to stage guerrilla strikes that harassed and punished Soviet forces around the capital. Pakistan's covert supply lines ran through the highlands of the two Waziristans, but especially through North Waziristan. By the account of a former ISI officer who ran logistics during the covert war, the Haqqanis received as much as 12,000 tons of supplies every year. Jalaluddin and his brothers poured their funds into the construction of religious schools on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border, an archipelago of influence, shelter, ideological support, and fresh student recruits. In 1980, they built an elaborate flagship madrasa in Dandedapakel, outside Mehransah, the tribal agency's capital. Urban North Waziristan was an ideal base of operations. It lay beyond the reach of Soviet ground forces, beyond the writ of the Pakistani government, yet it was proximate to the battlefield and to supply lines fed by ISI and the CIA. Just inside Afghanistan, in a natural citadel, Jawara, the Haqqanis and ISI constructed a massive base and training center, ultimately consisting of dozens of buildings and underground tunnels and arms depots. The project benefited from Osama bin Laden's aid and participation. The Haqqanis did more than any other commander network in Afghanistan to nurture and support Arab volunteer fighters, seeding al-Qaeda's birth. During the late 1980s, the CIA adopted a strategy of providing cash directly to anti-Soviet commanders, in addition to funneling the money through ISI. A case officer operating under non-official cover outside the embassy handled the Haqqani account and provided hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Haqqani family, in turn, was professional and efficient. It maintained representative offices in Peshawar, Islamabad, and Riyadh for ease of doing business. During the early 1990s, the family used its control of an airstrip in Khost to export scrap metal gathered from the war's detritus, earning millions. They published magazines and ran a radio station. American and NATO intelligence officers would come to spend long hours after 2001 trying to evaluate the Haqqani's loyalties to ISI, to the Taliban, to al-Qaeda. The record makes plain that the family valued its independence. The Haqqanis maintained alliances and client ties to ISI, but they were also estranged at times from the Pakistani service. Equally, the Haqqanis swore fealty to Mullah Muhammad Omar and the Taliban after they took power, and cooperated with the Taliban on the battlefield, but there were also strains from time to time. The Haqqanis differed with the Taliban's bans on music and women's access to education. The family allowed CARE International to build co-educational schools in territory it controlled around Khost. Musharraf's decision to back the United States in its war against the Taliban presented the Haqqanis with a profound dilemma. Jalaluddin visited Islamabad in October 2001 and held ambiguous meetings with ISI officers and American interlocutors. By one account, the Bush administration demanded only a form of unconditional surrender. The longtime Pakistan-based correspondent Kathy Gannon reported that Pakistan told the Haqqanis to hold firm against the Americans and await ISI aid. In any event, Jalaluddin made his decision clear in an interview as he left the Pakistani capital. We will retreat to the mountains and begin a long guerrilla war to claim our pure land from infidels and free our country like we did against the Soviets. Then in his early 60s, scarred by war injuries, Jalaluddin commanded the family enterprise. He relied on two of his younger brothers, Ibrahim and Khalil, both educated at the Haqqaniya Madrasa as he had been, to negotiate and mediate on the family's behalf. Ibrahim in particular evolved into a kind of ambassador. After the fall of the Taliban, Ibrahim moved to Kabul. The Haqqanis did not reconcile formally with Hamid Karzai's administration, but Ibrahim's presence signaled that they were open to discussions. The Haqqanis had fought with Ahmad Shah Massoud during the 1980s and against him during the mid-1990s. They were masters of violent coexistence. During 2002, Ibrahim Haqqani had even established contact with CIA officers in Gardez and had been helpful. In November 2002, he visited the station at the Ariana Hotel to talk with CIA officers. A senior officer named Mike, in Afghanistan on a second tour, was working on a plan with the agency's Paris station chief to persuade Ibrahim to arrange a meeting with Jalaluddin in the United Arab Emirates. Mike wanted to propose that the Haqqanis help the CIA locate Osama bin Laden. At the Ariana, speaking through a Pashto translator, Mike warned Ibrahim that the United States would track down and kill his brother if he didn't cooperate. If the Haqqanis used intermediaries and distanced themselves from the betrayal of bin Laden, they might end up better off, enhancing their prestige and creating new conditions for their own influence. They were businessmen. They would weigh the costs and benefits, as well as the requirements of their faith. If not bin Laden, perhaps they would help with Ayman al-Zawahiri or Mullah Muhammad Omar. The gambit fell apart before the hypothesis could be tested. A victim, as one CIA officer involved saw it, a fraying trust and communication between the CIA and special forces in Afghanistan. At Bagram Airfield, CIA officers marked off their computer terminals with the equivalent of yellow police tape to prevent Defense Department personnel from looking at their screens, an almost comical expression of the agency's posture toward everyone else in the government. The CIA's clandestine service had long struggled to overcome its reputation for arrogance. The agency's elan and mythology of omniscience and power was a key aspect of its effectiveness in the field, in the same way that great salesmen drive expensive cars in order to influence clients with the shine of their success. Yet if a certain degree of constructed hubris was an aspect of spying tradecraft, it also invited self-delusion. The CIA never stopped projecting its claim to be the elite of the elite. Yet, while the senior intelligence service certainly had star performers and jaw-dropping stories of bravery and daring to tell, it also had fools and screamers in its ranks, who authored operational failures that colleagues elsewhere in U.S. intelligence and the military had no trouble learning about, if they had the right clearances. Stan McChrystal, then on his way to lead Joint Special Operations Command, traveling in and out of Afghanistan, felt the CIA had a culture of insularity. The attitude they projected was, "Nobody should tell us what to do. We got it. We are special." He thought the agency attracted strong talent, but they don't have very good leadership. There was no system for selecting and forging successful leaders over careers, as the military sought to do. Whether a CIA station chief was an exemplary decision-maker or a whacked-out freelancer seemed to McChrystal almost random, serendipitous, a matter of rotation schedules and internal politics. And the CIA tended to regard military officers and units with barely disguised condescension. There were exceptions like Greg Vogel or Chris Wood, whom McChrystal latched onto as peers and collaborators. But in general, they weren't as good as they thought they were, and we weren't as bad as they thought, he believed. The CIA's assessment, in turn, was that the Pentagon special operators were shooters and door crashers who lacked regional expertise and situational awareness. McChrystal made it his mission to fix the working relationship, but it was a project that turned out to be measured in years. Even as Ibrahim Haqqani talked cooperatively with the CIA through one channel, a special unit in Kabul Station targeted him for arrest. The unit was made up of a mix of CIA officers and special forces personnel, and its operations were heavily compartmented, meaning knowledge of its existence and work was restricted to those judged to have a need to know, even within the CIA. The CIA and special forces kept their own lists of high-level al-Qaeda and allied targets. Somehow, Ibrahim made the list, even though he was meeting with Mike and other officers in Kabul and elsewhere. The Kabul station chief, a successor to Rich Blee, knew that Ibrahim had been targeted but did not share this with Mike or others. On May 4, 2003, the Black Operations Unit basically jumped the guy and arrested Ibrahim. As a CIA document put it later, the agency at higher levels judged that he did not merit detention by the CIA. Haqqani ended up in the custody of the National Directorate of Security and later U.S. military custody, according to the CIA. Haqqani told American interlocutors years later that he was tortured. His fate signaled the descent of American counterterrorism policy into black depths of systematic abuse. Chapter 9. His rules were different than our rules. By the late spring of 2003, the Omega teams of special forces, CIA officers and contractors, eavesdroppers, and Afghan armed reconnaissance militias had settled in a string of mud fort bases along the Afghan side of the border with Pakistan. The clandestine bases ran from Asadabad in the north to Shkin in the south. The CIA's private army, counter-terrorist pursuit teams in agency jargon, numbered about 7,000 men, the agency told counterpart services. The forward bases also supported smaller tactical HUMINT teams, or THTs. They consisted of expatriate case officers and Afghan interpreters, often Tajiks and Hazaras, whose ethnicity could strain relations with local Pashtuns. All of them could access the national language of Dari, but the locals preferred Pashto, which the Tajik and Hazara interpreters did not always speak fluently. The basic task was to talk to locals on what were called local civil action trips. "Who wants to cooperate?" the teams would ask, as a participant described it. "Who wants to be a human source?" "Talk to the tribal elders. It was tough. They were very hesitant to talk with us." The priorities for collection were number 1, Bin Laden, number 2, Zawahiri, or AQSL, Al-Qaeda Senior Leadership. Some of the deployed case officers had long experience in the Middle East, if little acquaintance with Pakistan and Afghanistan. Some were retirees in their 60s back on contract. Increasingly, the rotators included very inexperienced case officers fresh out of career training in Virginia. They typically paid their human agents about $500 a month to wander the border area and report back. The American officers referred to their agents by their national file number, or NFN, which concluded in a number, so that reported sounded like NFN-37 has departed for Khost, and NFN-113 is expected from Quetta. The more entrepreneurial Pashtun agents would take a salary from a CIA case officer at Shkin, then walk to Gardez and link up with a DIA HUMINT team for another $1,000. "They were wandering triple dippers," the participant said. The local agents typically did not have bicycles or motorcycles. They walked. "I'll see you in a month," they would tell a case officer. "It will take a week to walk to my house, 2 weeks to do the surveillance, and another week to walk back to you." Navy SEALs supported the THTs with direct raiding capability if a target could be identified. Increasingly, the teams were drawn into local violence against the Mukhalafin, as they were referred to in Pashto, meaning the rivals or opposition. It was a suitably vague term. There were too many violent groups to characterize accurately under any one label. They included the Hizbi Islami, led by Gulbadin Hekmatyar, known as HIG in American jargon, pronounced like pig, as well as Haqqani commanders, Taliban veterans, timber smugglers, tribal rivals, and local boys enlisted to fight for a salary. The Omega bases contained bored SEALs and Deltas working out every day for weeks at a time with nothing to do, begging for villages to raid, as the participant put it. They didn't want to spend too much time confirming the targets. It also became apparent that the very presence of forward-deployed Americans in the border bases provoked local attacks, almost reflexively. This was the case at Asadabad Fire Base, which lay in a river basin in Kunar province, a forbidding region of peaks and gorges stretching northwest from Jalalabad. Elements of the 82nd Airborne, a pair of Special Forces A-teams, and a CIA contingent shared a compound perhaps 200 yards by 200 yards. Its mud brick walls were 10 feet high and 2 feet thick. Kashmiri guerrillas had used the fort during the 1990s to train to fight against India's military. A dozen flat-roofed huts attached to the outer walls served as bunks, offices, storage depots, and detention centers. It was cold and muddy. A third-world cesspool, in the words of Brian Halstead, a non-commissioned Special Forces officer who served there. At irregular intervals, sometimes several times daily, someone out there among the woods-shrouded mukhalafin shot off artillery rockets at the firebase. The valley was quiet but for birds and the rustle of pines, so the Americans could hear the crack of a rocket launch and then count the seconds before it exploded nearby. The attacks were unnerving, but usually poorly aimed. Halstead was the Special Forces intelligence officer in charge of force protection in Kunar. Every time a rocket smashed into or near the base, he analyzed the crater, examined radar to trace the location from where it had been fired, and plotted the patterns on a map. He also talked to locals for insight. He had been serving on Special Forces A-teams for 2 decades around the world, and knew by now that it was essential to spend a lot of time and effort building personal relationships. Last thing you want to do is go out there and get in the middle of somebody's tribal vendettas. Asadabad Firebase's principal local contact was Saeed Fazal Akbar, the governor of Kunar, who had been running a clothing store in Oakland on September 11th. He served Hamid Karzai as a spokesman before the interim leader appointed him as his man in Asadabad. Akbar occupied the governor's mansion and brought along his son, Haider, then 18, who had been raised in California and spoke fluent American-accented English. He would soon attend Yale University. Their outpost of the Karzai regime was barely more rooted in Kunar society than the firebase's roving squads of bearded Americans. At some point that spring, a CIA colleague mentioned to Brian Halstead the name Abdul Wali as a suspected organizer of the rocketing they endured. The basis for this suspicion wasn't clear, but if the grounds for suspicion were adequate, one of Halstead's standard procedures was to try to puck the suspect to conduct further questioning. Puck was an invented verb derived from person under control, or PUC, a category of prisoner status under post-2001 Pentagon policy. To puck someone at a firebase was to incarcerate them for a limited number of days for intelligence interrogation, to determine if the individual should be released or transferred to the larger detention facility at Bagram Airfield. That spring, Asadabad Firebase informed Governor Akbar about Abdul Wali, and the word went out to local villages that he was a wanted man. One mid-June afternoon, Abdul Wali appeared at Governor Akbar's compound with his brother and some elders from his village. The governor's son, Haider, joined the meeting. Abdul Wali told them he was afraid that an informer had ratted him out to the Americans as part of a tribal feud. The governor assured him that if he was innocent, the Akbars would provide zamanat about the Americans, a kind of guarantee or personal backing under Islamic law. All Abdul Wali had to do was go talk to the Americans to straighten things out. Abdul Wali was frightened. He said he had heard rumors of torture at the American base. Everything from beating and sleep deprivation to disembowelment. "That's nonsense," Governor Akbar assured his guest. "I know the Americans. I've been there myself. The Americans don't do things like that." But Abdul Wali was still afraid to go to the base. Finally, the governor said, "My son is here from America. He's schooled in English, and he'll go and escort you to the base, and he'll be your translator." That satisfied him. They drove to Firebase Asadabad in a pickup truck. On the way, Abdul Wali was shaking a little. Haider tried to tell him to calm down. The Americans received them in an interview room near the gate. Brian Halstead opened the questioning calmly and took notes. "Were you ever involved with the Taliban? Were you involved with Al-Qaeda? Were you involved with HIG?" Abdul Wali answered, "No." Then Halstead asked if he had recently been to Pakistan. Abdul Wali admitted that he had, to settle some debts, but he couldn't remember how long he had stayed or what dates he had traveled. Haider Akbar thought this apparent forgetfulness reflected local understandings of time. Visiting his father in Kunar reminded him of a time travel movie he saw advertised as a kid in California, where one of the characters in the film declares, "My father is stuck in the 14th century. I have to go get him back." When Haider came to Kunar, he felt he was going to visit my dad in the 14th century. One of the Time Warp's characteristics was that nobody kept calendars or made specific appointments. People don't know how old they are. They don't keep track of time. Yet he could tell in the interview room that Abdul Wali's vagueness about his trip to Pakistan was raising suspicion among some of his interrogators. David Passaro was one of two CIA personnel in the room. He was a former policeman, twice divorced, who looked like an out-of-shape Sylvester Stallone, Haider thought. He was a CIA contractor, not a career officer. About 85% of the CIA personnel who conducted interrogations after 2001 were contractors. Interrogation had never been a skill taught at the farm, the CIA's career training academy. David Passaro's boss, the Asadabad chief of base, went by the cover name Stephen Jones. He was a career officer who, like Passaro, was a former police officer. The two CIA men joined the questioning of Abdul Wali, but Jones seemed to become bored after 10 or 15 minutes and left, according to Haider Akbar. Passaro became aggressive. He leaned into Abdul Wali, stared at him menacingly, spoke in a contemptuous tone, and threatened him. "If you are lying to me, you, your whole family, your kids, they could all get hurt from this." Haider Akbar became upset and stopped translating. Another interpreter took over. Passaro only became angrier. Finally, he announced that Abdul Wali would be pucked. Passaro asked his prisoner, "Is there anything you want to give to your family before you are taken away?" Abdul Wali stuttered that there was nothing. He was almost in a state of shock, Haider thought, because it sounded as if Passaro was saying, "We're taking you out back and shooting you." Haider was sickened. He had just finished high school. He was an American citizen who had returned to help the war-broken country of his family's origins. Yet here he was watching an American-led version of what the Soviets did in Afghanistan. As Haider departed, he put his hand on Abdul Wali's shoulder to reassure him. "Just tell the truth," he advised. "Just tell the truth." Soldiers handcuffed the prisoner, placed an empty sandbag over his head, and led him to a detention cell, where he was shackled to the floor. Enlisted soldiers guarded Abdul Wali on 4-hour shifts. That night, David Passaro turned up at the cell while the enlisted soldier Matthew Johnson was on duty. Passaro announced that Abdul Wali was a CIA prisoner and that he would be handling the interrogation. He warned Johnson that his techniques might be harsher than what military guards were used to seeing. "His rules were different than our rules," was the way Johnson would remember Passaro's explanation. "He didn't fall under the Geneva Convention as we did. His only rule was not to cause permanent injury." Passaro entered an adjoining cell, got a chair, made a lot of racket in there, broke a chair apart, came out, and said he was ready to go into the room with Abdul Wali. He kicked the cell door open and hurled in a 2x4, striking Abdul Wali. He slammed the prisoner's head against the wall and shoved him onto the floor face first, all while the prisoner was shackled, cuffed, and still had a bag over his head. Pissarro hoisted Abdul-Wali into a stress position, squatting with arms out, and questioned him. Dissatisfied, Pissarro hit him, kicked him, and knocked him back onto the floor. "If you don't give the answers I want," Pissarro said, "it's going to get worse." David Pissarro's belief that he operated by special CIA rules traced back to an initially ad hoc, confused response inside the counter-terrorist center after September 11th to the unexpected problem of prisoner detention and interrogation. President Bush's covert action, Memorandum of Notification, 6 days after the attacks, gave the CIA authority to kill terrorists, as well as to detain and question them. The agency was poorly prepared to run prisons. On September 27th, CIA headquarters cabled stations worldwide that any future agency prison would be designed to meet U.S. POW standards. Official CIA policy at the time held that all direct interrogations carried out by agency personnel should follow the U.S. Army Field Manual standards, which prohibited physical abuse. After initial discussions about detention planning that fall, as the Afghan war sped forward, Kofor Black wrote CIA Director Tenet that having the Pentagon take charge of all detention facilities would be the best option. If the CIA maintained its own prisons, Black warned, captured terrorists may be held days, months, or years, and the likelihood of exposure will grow over time. Eventual press exposure of the operation could inflame public opinion against the host government and the U.S. He urged Tenet to persuade Rumsfeld to take responsibility. As al-Qaeda prisoners fled Afghanistan after Tora Bora and fell into Pakistani custody, the question of whether the CIA should adopt an independent detention program became more urgent. The agency had a dark history in this field, as career officers in CTC and on the 7th floor well knew. During the Cold War, the agency had produced the Kubar Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, which provided for the use of techniques such as sensory deprivation, threats and fear, debility, pain, and hypnosis. The agency brutally interrogated a Soviet defector, Yuri Nosenko, between 1964 and 1967, believing that he was an imposter. During the 1980s, some of those techniques found their way into the CIA's Human Resource Exploitation Training Manual, which was shared with liaison services in Latin America. During the 1990s, the agency had reversed policy to track the Army's compliance with the Geneva Conventions. One reason the military favored humane treatment of prisoners was the probability that its own uniformed personnel would be captured. The Pentagon had sought before 2001 to promote positive reciprocity. Yet the Counterterrorist Center nonetheless managed a covert program that involved its officers, at least indirectly, with the torture of terrorism suspects, right up until September 11th. This program involved a counterterrorism practice known as rendition, or extraordinary rendition. If an Egyptian radical with ties to violence was arrested in Albania, the CIA might take possession of the prisoner secretly and fly him on a private jet to Cairo to hand the suspect over to Egyptian authorities. American presidents since Ronald Reagan had approved the practice. The program allowed the Counterterrorist Center to work with Allied intelligence and police services to keep terrorist suspects in custody when there was not sufficient evidence to bring the suspects to the United States to face American criminal charges. Several of the countries that partnered with the CIA in this way, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria among them, had documented records of extensive human rights abuses against prisoners. As a practical matter, in those countries, it was common knowledge that the secret police routinely and often grotesquely tortured prisoners, including Islamist radicals. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and even the State Department had published libraries of documentary evidence. To evade this stain, the CIA officially required governments receiving suspects under the rendition program to promise not to abuse them. But few involved were naive enough to think this was anything but a face-saving exchange of paper for the sake of lawyers and Congress. In addition to the moral problem, indirect interrogations by secret police employing torture produced imperfect intelligence. The agency had acknowledged in congressional briefings that torture produced false testimony. Even where abusive questioning by Egyptian or Syrian police might also produce reliable information, we couldn't control interviews done by others, had limited ability to ask time-urgent follow-on questions, and were constrained by whatever the liaison service wanted to withhold or invent for its own reasons, as the counterterrorist center's Jose Rodriguez put it. Even close allies didn't have the same interest in prioritizing American security over other interests when conducting prisoner interrogations. Even so, during the late 1990s, the Clinton administration had embraced rendition of terrorism prisoners to countries such as Egypt as an essential tool in its campaign against Al-Qaeda. About 70 prisoners were shuttled from one country to another by the CIA during the Clinton years. The branch also carried out more straightforward renditions, bringing indicted criminals to the United States to face trial. The Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Group inside the Counterterrorist Center contracted for Gulfstream jets, pilots, and security guards, and managed these transfers. Yet the Renditions Group was mainly a prisoner transfer outfit. It operated no prisons of its own and had no cadre of expert interrogators. The Counterterrorist Center had another connection to the black arts of torture. Its Psychological Operations Group had ties to Special Forces counterparts at Fort Bragg. The base was home to the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Program, or SEER, which sought to prepare pilots and other personnel for the possibility of capture. The program used psychologists to act as enemy interrogators and deliberately placed thousands of American trainees under intense physical and psychological pressure to help them learn what they might have to endure in captivity. The Air Force and the Navy had used waterboarding on thousands of trainees as part of the curriculum. The CIA's Counterterrorist Center had several ties to the SEER program. Rick Prado, one of Kofor Black's deputies, had gone through the training when he was an Air Force Special Operations Rescue Specialist, before he joined the CIA, although he had not been placed on a waterboard. The agency also maintained ties to James Mitchell, an Air Force psychologist who had worked in the SEER program, and Bruce Jessen, who had also worked there. Mitchell retired from the military in mid-2001. That year, the CIA hired him as an advisor. By the following spring, he was consulting for the Counterterrorist Center. Mitchell and Jessen were familiar with a document recovered in Manchester, England, that appeared to be a manual for Al-Qaeda and allied volunteers, suggesting how they might resist interrogation based on an understanding of the techniques employed by interrogators. They wrote a paper for the CIA about how to recognize when Al-Qaeda prisoners might be resisting interrogation. They pointed out that the manual instructed Al-Qaeda prisoners to stick to a pre-coordinated cover story during interrogation, request legal counsel, complain about treatment and conditions, ask for medical attention, and then report that they have been tortured and mistreated regardless of the actual events. At CTC, Mitchell joined a discussion about how to overcome such tactics through the application of various kinds of pressure on prisoners. Some CIA officers threw around terms like learned helplessness, an idea derived from experiments carried out on dogs by University of Pennsylvania psychologists during the 1960s. In the CIA's distorted adaptation of the work, it considered whether, if a prisoner concluded that he had lost control over his conditions, in addition to becoming passive and depressed, he might also cooperate with his jailers. A problem with this hypothesis was that learned helplessness actually describes conditions where the subject is so broken and discouraged that he won't even try to escape, given the opportunity. It was not a good way to encourage cooperation. That required the prisoner to have a sense of hope for improvement. Mitchell and Jessen later said that they tried to impress upon CIA officers new to the field that the purpose of SEER interrogation techniques was to induce the prisoner to cooperate. Early in 2002, an Al-Qaeda operative named Abu Zubaydah, who was well known to the Counterterrorist Center, surfaced in telephone intercepts from Pakistan. He was a Palestinian who had been raised in Saudi Arabia and had been one of the few Al-Qaeda suspects to speak openly on the telephone and use email over a period of years. His visibility and his involvement in arranging travel and housing for Al-Qaeda members heightened the CIA's interest in him. The early 2002 intercepts showed that Zubeda was in Pakistan, but not where. The CTC formed a headquarters task force to hunt him down, with forward elements deployed to the Islamabad station. In late March, anticipating Zubeda's capture, the agency renewed debate about its detention and interrogation options. On March 27th, the CIA produced a PowerPoint presentation, Options for Incarcerating Abu Zubeda. The presentation rejected putting the Pentagon in control, in large part because of the lack of security and the fact that Abu Zubeda would have to be declared to the International Committee of the Red Cross, as Senate investigators later put it, summarizing the classified slide deck. The PowerPoint also raised doubts about Guantanamo Bay because of its lack of secrecy and the possible loss of control to U.S. military and or FBI. On March 28th, Pakistani forces raided a house in Faisalabad, Pakistan, shot and wounded Abu Zubeda, and placed him in custody at a Pakistani military hospital. George Tenet approved a proposal to approach Thailand about hosting a secret prison where Zubeda could be held and questioned. Tenet discussed the plan with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and her deputy Stephen Hadley so they could brief President Bush. On March 29th, Bush approved the CIA's plan. The FBI sent agents to question Zubeda. The CIA sent a career officer to run the base and also dispatched James Mitchell for advice. Abu Zubeda was placed in an all-white room that was lit 24 hours a day. Mitchell later defended the detention conditions as necessary to supervise the prisoner's wounds and medical care. The CIA's team clashed with FBI agents, including an Arabic-speaking agent named Ali H. Soufan, who sought to use the interrogation methods of law enforcement, which are designed to establish a close rapport with the prisoner, to draw him gradually into disclosures, and to build a legal case that would stand scrutiny in a court of law. The CIA's officers, still animated by fear of some unknown Al-Qaeda nuclear plot, urgently sought information from the prisoner that would prevent future attacks. The CIA's officers and consulting psychologist acquired tremendous influence, an FBI agent reported to his headquarters. The CIA's prisons now departed from Army Field Manual and FBI practices into a science fiction-tinged dystopia of intimidation and dominance over prisoners. A CIA cable from April described Zubeda's cell in Thailand as white, with no natural lighting or windows, but with four halogen lights pointed into the cell. An air conditioner was also in the room. A white curtain separated the interrogation room from the cell. Security officers wore all black uniforms, including boots, gloves, balaclavas, and goggles, to protect the officers' identities, but also to prevent the prisoner from seeing the security guards as individuals who he may attempt to establish a relationship or dialogue with. The stage was set for the most shockingly bureaucratized descent into the application of pseudoscience on human subjects by the CIA since the agency's notorious MK-Ultra project during the 1950s and 1960s, in which agency operatives used LSD and other drugs on involuntary subjects in an effort to develop techniques for mind control. Early in May 2002, Tenet informed Kofor Black that he wanted to make a change in the counter-terrorist center's leadership. Tenet said he was proud of Black's work before and after September 11th and retained confidence in him, but that it was time for a change. "I did not volunteer to leave," Black admitted later, "and of course I will say that I was tired. No doubt about that." His struggles to elevate the counterterrorism mission within the CIA bureaucracy had placed Black in relentless conflict with colleagues over slots and budgets. These were trying psychological circumstances because there was a lot of competition with other components in the agency, as he put it. "So we were having to fight all the time." Tenet offered Black any job he wanted at CIA. But Black and his wife did not want to go overseas again, and he certainly didn't want to run a part of the bureaucracy that had been resisting counterterrorism, as he saw it. He ended up accepting nomination as the State Department's Global Counterterrorism Ambassador. Tenet's decision to replace Black was seen by some at CTC as a revanchist victory by James Pavitt and the regional leaders in the mainstream Directorate of Operations. The Africa Division clan that had gathered around Black before and after September 11th now scattered. Rich Blee rotated out of Kabul Station that spring. The CIA offered him a management position, but he wanted something closer to the action, so he contacted the FBI and asked if they would take him on as a special CIA advisor at the Bureau, starting in the summer of 2002. Hank Crumpton took an academic sabbatical, studying for a master's degree at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Tenet elevated Jose Rodriguez to replace Black as the Counterterrorist Center's director. To many insiders, Rodriguez recognized, it was quite a surprise. He had spent the great majority of his career in Latin America and had only modest experience in counterterrorism, yet he was being handed a position where you might expect to find the most seasoned Arabic-speaking Middle East hand. Rodriguez had grown up in South America and the Caribbean before arriving in the United States at about 18 to attend the University of Florida. After finishing law school there, he joined the CIA as an operative. He was a classmate of Cofer Black's at the farm. He rose into the Senior Intelligence Service, but had setbacks. At one point he was removed as Latin American Division Chief in the Directorate of Operations after what he considered to be a very biased and unfair Inspector General investigation of actions he had taken to aid an imprisoned friend. Yet Rodriguez had suffered no serious harm from that reprimand and went on to run the CIA station in Mexico City. He was a hard-line but popular figure, humorous, an attentive manager, but he was not known as a geopolitical thinker or a sophisticated Washington hand. He avoided delivering congressional briefings, sending more polished analysts in his stead. As evidenced by his dust-up with the CIA's Inspector General, his antennae about what might be regarded as controversial or unethical were not always reliable. Rodriguez was very close to Rick Prado, the SEER graduate who had worked on the front lines of the Contra-guerrilla war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, a rough conflict. Prado had no role in decision-making about interrogation methods for CIA prisoners, but he and Rodriguez both regarded squeamishness about harsh interrogations as misplaced and naive, a symptom of political correctness, in Rodriguez's phrase, that had to be set aside given that we were under the constant threat of new and even more deadly attacks, and time was of the essence. Prado reminded him, referring to his own experience of SEER, alongside many other Special Forces trainees, I've been through this crap, and so has every G.I. Joe that ever wore a funny hat in the military. It's not plucking fingernails. Of course, the military men who endured SEER were volunteers, and were given a safe word to exclaim if they felt in jeopardy. That would not be true of CIA prisoners. The CIA team was recalled to headquarters in May. Rodriguez felt the FBI had done what it could to interrogate Zubeda, but when the prisoner recovered his strength, he stopped cooperating. In July 2002, Rodriguez asked Mitchell how long it would take them to put more aggressive pressure on the prisoner than the noise and sleep deprivation that had already been employed, in order to determine whether Zubeda would break or was the sort of hard man to take any secrets with him to the grave. Mitchell and Rodriguez met often. On July 8th, they attended a meeting with CIA officers from Alex Station, the Office of Medical Services, agency lawyers, an FBI liaison, and others. Afterward, according to Mitchell, he drew up a list of possible techniques at the CTC director's request. He said later that he was concerned that otherwise the government would just proceed to beat Zubeda up, and that would produce, in his experience, no useful information. Mitchell's initial list of techniques did not include waterboarding, according to him. He added that technique later after reflecting upon how, in SEER training, as he now told Rodriguez, the thing that is rumored to be most effective on Navy fighter pilots is waterboarding. Mitchell had no idea if it was legal. He thought the CIA would bring someone in to evaluate that. Rodriguez asked Mitchell to join the effort. A career CIA officer would control the secret prison and was ultimately responsible, but Mitchell would be the lead subject matter expert. Mitchell speculated that they would know whether Zubeda would break in 30 days if they were given permission to apply the new techniques. The FBI withdrew its agents. Director Robert Mueller, a Princeton-educated former Marine and federal prosecutor, was a politically sophisticated Washington hand. Arriving at the Bureau that summer, Rich Blee advocated for joint interrogations teams made up of Bureau agents and CIA officers, teams that would combine FBI interrogation expertise with the CIA's worldwide intelligence collection. But Mueller could see where the CIA was going in Thailand, with Tenet's full support, and he wanted no part of it. Tenet fronted for Jose Rodriguez with the Bush White House. John Rizzo, the CIA's general counsel, insisted that the Department of Justice write memos expressing an opinion about whether the harsh techniques Mitchell described were legal. By August 1st, J.S. Bybee, an assistant attorney general, had issued internal classified memoranda later infamous as the torture memos. They ratified the legality of 10 of the CIA's proposed enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, but not mock burial, a second severe technique that Mitchell had originally listed and that Rodriguez had proposed. Even though 10 months had passed, and there had been no follow-on attacks even approaching the scale of September 11th, there remained a hysteria that more attacks were coming, as a senior intelligence official involved put it. That was just the consensus. A second factor was that the CIA and allied European intelligence services had developed scant insights into al-Qaeda's leadership despite a full year of effort. Bin Laden and Zawahiri had disappeared. They and other leaders had curtailed electronic communications. Human agent reporting, such as the Fire Ant program along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, had produced only fragmented and even counterproductive intelligence. Fresh al-Qaeda detainees looked more promising. Abu Zubaydah's knowledge of al-Qaeda operations would be recent enough to be helpful. If he could be made to disclose what he knew accurately, he could provide life-saving insights not otherwise available, the thinking went. "We were flying blind," a former senior British intelligence officer recalled. "We didn't know who was where and what they were doing. Detainee debriefings were all we had." Robert Gates, a career CIA analyst who later served as Secretary of Defense for both the Bush and Obama administrations, later blamed the overload of threat reporting arriving each day at the desks of cabinet and senior White House officials with all the filters off and no sound way to determine which intelligence was reliable and which was not. A lot of the measures, including the renditions, Guantanamo, the enhanced interrogation techniques, all were out of a sense of desperation to get information because we had so little. Rodriguez remained convinced that he had made the right decisions, sought the right approvals, and delivered results in fresh intelligence from prisoners subjected to waterboarding that justified his risk-taking. Hardline officers in the Bin Laden unit of CTC and elsewhere at the agency, including in Tenet's office, backed him fully. If there were dissenters in the CIA informed of the decisions and willing to risk their careers to stop the plan in the summer of 2002, their whistleblowing remains unknown. One basic problem was competence and experience. At the CIA and MI6, its British counterpart, detainee interrogation is no part of a foreign intelligence officer's training, as the former British officer put it. So the CIA turned to contractors who claimed to know what they were doing. The moral and strategic failures that flowed from the CIA interrogation program born that summer, as well as similar programs in Iraq and Guantanamo, approved by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, had many consequences. One was to color the experience a significant number of Afghans had of the American intervention in their country. Bagram served as prisoner collection and transshipment point for the CIA and the Pentagon. Record-keeping by the CIA was so poor that investigators later had difficulty piecing together which prisoners had been under the agency's control at Bagram and what had been done to them. Beatings, shouting, humiliation, and threats